It is Saturday, January 19th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news, and the second half, your questions and comments of technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. During today's show, we will be covering the week in geek news. There's quite a bit of it. And in the second half, we'll welcome your calls and questions of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour.
Talk of the Bay is your source for interviews about local arts and public affairs, as well as the national issues that hit home here on the Central Coast. The Talk of the Bay team brings you in-depth analysis and discussion, including Art Studio, The Washington Report, The Sacramento Report, and The Performing Arts Calendar, Monday through Friday from 10 to 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
Well, thank you very much, Drew, for that, and I'll just introduce you first. This is Drew Meyer, Product Manager at Network Appliance. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, the rest of the geeks are Sean Cleveland, Senior Technical Marketing Manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Morning.
Was that a yawn?
Yeah.
It's because you got up too early to get your Prius fixed. And Ben Jaffe, what's your title? Geek student? Sure. We'll go with that. Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay, good. You're there.
Yeah.
Whew, I wasn't sure if the mic was up. I got to test these things. And Ryder Brooks, Support Engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
Good morning. Oh.
So a bit happened this week. Last week we covered a lot of CES stuff, and this week's show was Macworld. So I guess we should just jump into the Macworld news stories. And Ben, I'll ask you to start with that.
That's why Sean was yawning.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, Apple introduced the MacBook Air, which is a very, very thin laptop with not as many features, not
as
much
anyone needs.
Power, very expensive, big premium for the small size.
Yeah. That's my take on it, too. It's just too expensive for what it is.
But, really impressive, I guess, from an engineering standpoint, that they could, you know, get something that small.
It's like a
physical design engineering.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like at a car show when you see a car, you're like, ooh, that's cool. It's not going to work on a road, but it's really neat.
Yeah, aesthetically.
Yeah,
this but a 1.6 gigahertz Core 2 processor, very lightweight.
Yeah.
Integrated graphics.
Intel's integrated graphics.
Integrated graphics.
Not so hot.
It's going to be horrible.
Because it's not NVIDIA.
Well, you know, I hate to say it.
But does NVIDIA make something that would go in a thin and light notebook?
Oh, God,
like
yes. It's so easy to compete against Intel's integrated graphics. I got to tell you, we make videos.
Disclosure, wait a minute. Maybe not everyone knows what I'm. Yeah. While we're teasing Sean about
this. Well, we
this.
Just
I work
that
at
Sean
NVIDIA. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, it really is easy to compete against Intel with their integrated graphics. They're that bad.
That's harsh. Now, this board is kind of an interesting feat of engineering. If he actually showed it, Steve Jobs showed it in the keynote. It's the length of a pencil, and it's about the height of a deck of cards. It's a small board. And that has the graphics on it and the processor and the memory.
Mm-hmm. That's really,
not the memory.
Yeah, but the rest of it is all battery.
Yeah.
And it
yeah,
gets you like
yeah.
5 hours.
Yeah.
Normal,
I mean, that's
with
nice.
The 1.6 gigahertz
processor.
Well, you
know, an interesting point about the battery is it's technically not user replaceable. You void your warranty if you try and if you replace it. Although it's very easy. There's reports that it's basically a Phillips head screwdriver in 2 minutes and you're set.
Now, how responsible is that? Are you supposed to throw the whole machine away when it's
No, you're
died?
Supposed to send it in. And $130 later and probably 10 days later, you
the iPod's
battery.
That way, too.
I think they said 2 or 3 days.
You know, though. And iPhone.
Or they probably have an express service. Yeah.
See, the thing is with that.
Well, that's shipping costing.
With that dilemma of Apple saying that the hard drive you have to send to us or you void your warranty. I'm sorry, the battery. The battery's not going to run out until after the warranty's run out. So it doesn't really matter. At that point, you're not going to have a warranty and you're going to have to do it any way you can.
Maybe there's a business opportunity there.
It probably is. There's a great company, actually, that does, I think it's called iFixit, and they sell parts and instruction manuals for all the Apple products, including the iPhone and the iPod and all that. And they can, you know, crack it open with a tool, and they show you how to do it. It's kind of fun videos. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that's with this machine is it's only got, like, 3 ports on it. It's got a sound out port, a USB port, and a DVI, mini DVI, a new micro mini DVI, whatever. That's not enough if you're doing anything with the computer. I mean, it doesn't even have an Ethernet port to connect up to the internet.
Yeah, or FireWire. Right.
Yeah, that is surprising, no Ethernet port.
Right.
So you have to rely on wireless.
But the one thing that came out with this that I really look forward to, and it's not actually the hardware itself, it's a piece of software that Apple's releasing that allows you to use a Windows machine or a Macintosh's CD or DVD drive remotely from this computer. So you install this little application that comes with it onto a Windows machine, and then you can actually tell Windows to share that CD drive over the Ethernet, over wirelessly, I guess, to a different device and install software that way, which is compelling to me because, you know, if I've got a broken drive, you can start using that. It also is more about this kind of ubiquitous use of drives, which I like. So that's a kind of exciting thing. But other than that, I think the hardware was pretty lousy. What else did they release? iPhone update.
There's an iPhone update and an iTouch update. The iPhone update is free. The iTouch update is $20
ridiculous
for the added applications.
You know, you already paid a lot for it. You might as well just get added for free.
Yeah.
The update from the iPhone, I hear, is not very stable.
Really?
So wait on it if you've got an iPhone. I'm waiting on it. I got an iPhone yesterday. It finally came in.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I like it. It's hard not to spend time on it all the time.
Kind of took you a long time to get it online last night. How long did it take you?
About 17 seconds. Actually, the biggest thing was I'd forgot to turn off my old phone, and somehow I couldn't dial out. I could receive a call, but I couldn't dial out without that.
That's what was going on.
Yeah, as soon as I turned off the other phone, it was no problem. So I don't know what that was. But
so you literally, last night, you sat down, hooked up your iPhone, and you plugged it in, you synced it, and did the registration, mm-hmm. which took you all of a few minutes.
And it was up and running, and it added I was able to use my AT&T account, and all I had to do is have like my zip and the social security number, or part of the social security number. And I was able to add to the bill and everything. No credit card entry, it was quite easy. I liked it a lot.
That's a huge part of the story of iPhone, is just how they really made that process easier.
Mm-hmm. How comfortable do you feel about privacy?
In what way? In Apple knowing my information?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I'm fairly comfortable. I mean, I already have accounts with Apple. I've already purchased stuff from Apple, so they kind of know who I am. There is a lot of, you know, that's of course a concern. But
Didn't I see a story? Maybe someone's going to cover it about the next version of Google Maps being able to work with GPS so you can tell exactly where you are when you turn your phone on.
That's the update that's most exciting, I think.
And in fact, it can even work with the iPod Touch that if you're connected to a Wi-Fi network, then it can locate you.
That's right. So they're doing triangulation from cell towers, so it's more location-based, it's more accurate on an iPhone because it's got the mm-hmm. GPS.
But again, it's a very general area.
Yeah,
like it'll give you
within a mile, they say, even though sometimes it hones
sometimes it just hits your building.
Okay, the last thing I want to talk about the Macworld so we can get onto other news is the release of movie rentals through iTunes. Is this impacting anybody? Is anybody excited about this?
Snore. TiVo can do it for you already.
Okay, but you have to have... Oh, TiVo for Amazon, that's right.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any feelings?
I've never used iTunes. I don't know.
So it is HD. You can rent HD movies and buy them, I think. But the rental, the one thing is that you pay for it, and then within a month you can download it and start watching it. And once you start watching it, you have 24 hours to finish watching, and then you will not be able to watch it anymore. And the movie rentals are equivalent to what would be at a video store. And they do have the HD ones, which have a premium cost. So the thing that was most impressive is he showed up the first screen, and it was all these kind of smaller movie publishers, right? And then he released the main screen, which is all the big players, you know, Paramount and Warner Brothers and Sony and, I mean, everybody, Disney, of course. So that was kind of compelling that Apple's been able to make a relationship with every major movie industry or movie release company and show their content.
Actually, I want to get a census of how many of us have actually watched a full-length movie. Better yet, how many movies have you watched on your computer?
Oh, I do it all the time.
Yeah, me too.
I never do it.
I do TV shows. I don't do movies.
Yeah.
I've probably watched maybe 10 movies.
Why do you watch it on your computer? It's got crappy speakers and a tiny screen.
Well, you hook in better speakers.
I have a 20-inch monitor and nice headphones and a baby sleeping in the other room.
Headphones. that makes sense.
I think on an airplane it would make sense. But, you know, you don't even have internet on most airplanes now. And can you stream when you're flying across the country?
We in our home, we have a cable coming from our Windows machine. It's an NVIDIA card that has an S-Video out that goes all the way to the TV and stereo sound. So I watch it on my TV, but it's coming from my computer.
I have a media center, too.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would actually... You know what? I pay for Comcast cable, and I can get most movies I want through that.
All right, so is that enough Macworld? Anything else? Good. All right, let's go on.
I have a question. Yeah. Wasn't Apple like anti-DRM? Like they were pushing?
Yeah, they are.
It seems like an odd move to start doing video rentals because, I mean, that's totally DRM controlled. I mean, it's kind of a hypocrisy of...
Well, I think DRMs kind of make sense in a rental situation. If you make an agreement with someone, I am only doing this for a certain period of time, some kind of digital enforcement makes sense. It's the idea of buying something and then being digitally restricted, which I don't like. And I don't know what they're doing with purchasing films, but I bet you anything it's DRM'd because there's no way the motion pictures.
When you buy episodes like the Daily TV? Show and stuff, does have digital right management included in them?
I believe they do.
So you can't copy them to another system.
I can copy them to a system, but I can only have up to 5 players that can actually play them. So okay. I need to move them to my laptop so I can try syncing them to my phone to see if that works. Because that's another thing with the iPhone or the iTunes purchasing thing is I have like 2 machines that are authenticated, and one of them I download TV shows and the other one I don't. Well, I'd have to move them manually between the two. I can't re-download on the other machine without repurchasing them. So that's kind of restrictive. And then they also released the whole Apple TV thing, but I still think that's a snore, so let's not even talk about it. Next news story, Drew, please.
Asteroids could hit Mars in January.
I think we covered this last week, but go on.
Well, the odds have been upgraded.
Oh, really?
There's a 1 in 75 chance now. Well, last week it was a 1 in 350 chance.
Well, that's exciting.
So you kind of took the wind out of my story.
I'm so sorry.
The solar wind, if you will.
Oh. But no, that's news, because last week the story was it's not going to happen. We found out it's not going to happen. This week it might happen.
The guys say the odds are, these odds are really unusual. Usually it's 1 to zillions, but 1 in 75 is, and they're upgrading it. And the closer it gets tomorrow, they're going to know more. And it's scheduled, if it hits, it probably will hit somewhere near where the rover Opportunity landed, but the rover won't be in danger. Now, I don't know why they can't tell if it's going to hit, but they know exactly where it would hit. But that's not a question. That's a question for the folks at UCSC. Anyway, there you go.
Thank you very much.
It's halfway between Earth and Mars right now, so be glad it's not Earth.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Sean?
Yeah, we've been talking about high-def cells and the death of HD-DVD the past few weeks. It seems that HD-DVD movies have not been selling as well as Blu-ray by a factor of around 2 up until CES, when all these, Warner... and various other studios, HBO, it started announcing they're going Blu-ray only. Since then, the split has been 85-15.
85-15 Blu-ray?
Blu-ray over HD-DVD sales.
So is that the nail going into the coffin?
Yeah. There's been some great videos on YouTube about the demise of HD-DVD.
One
of them tied to...
I don't know what movie that is.
I'd like to know. It's
a great scene of the end of Hitler's regime in the cabinet, if you will.
In the bunker.
And so I don't speak German. I don't know the film either. Maybe a caller will help us out. But it's overlaid as the story instead of the fall of the German control.
Of the Third Reich. The fall of HD-DVD.
It's a pretty funny bit.
But, there are a lot of big releases coming out for Blu-ray. Lord of the Rings, I think are really going to hurt HD-DVD.
So, did anyone buy an HD-DVD player?
I know a lot of people who did.
What's going to happen? They just like the Betamax?
The other problem is Blu-ray announced 2.0 specification at CES that adds a lot of, special features. And you have to have a player that has a firmware that's upgradable so that you can upgrade your player to play these new discs. So, I think they've kind of shot themselves in the foot. So people don't even want to go to Blu-ray until they get that stuff straightened out. So,
unless you have a PlayStation 3, which is already...
Yeah, PlayStation 3 can be updated with the firmware or any internal Blu-ray drive that's in your computer.
The specification is that it has a hard drive, network connection to update content.
Really?
Three releases of the Blu-ray spec.
So Blu-ray 2 requires a hard drive in the unit as well?
Yeah.
Interesting.
But it's nothing you really need to watch Blu-ray movies with.
Right. It's just added functionality.
HD-DVD has some really interesting things. The menu you can pop up during the movie. I don't know why you would do that, but
people I talk to
think it's neat. Yeah. But I don't know if they really use the feature.
How much is a HD-DVD or Blu-ray drive to buy for your computer?
About $300. Actually, for $300, you can buy one that plays both HD-DVD and Blu-ray from LG.
Does anyone own any HD-DVD movies? Okay, so right now, here's the bottom
so
line.
Why would you adopt any of this yet?
I kind of feel that way too.
But buy a hard drive for $300.
I think because people watch TV.
Yeah.
And they want to watch
big
difference.
Movies in HD. Oh yeah, Blu-ray. Let's put it this way: I'm not buying DVDs anymore. I'm just going to buy Blu-rays.
They're a lot more expensive.
It's that big of a difference in quality.
All right, so here's the bottom line from the Geek's recommendation. If you're planning on buying some high-definition content and you're going to buy a DVD player for high-definition, go ahead and get Blu-ray DVD. Do not get HD DVD. There. We've summed that up in a...
I think you should just wait.
Did
I don't think you should buy
that?
Anything. Yeah, I disagree.
I didn't vote on that. I say,
no,
get
that's
a
not
dual,
my recommendation.
I say get a dual-format player.
If you're desperate for the content, yeah.
Yeah.
If you can wait, give it six months.
Wait, so okay.
You know, it's not a bad idea is if you get a dual-format player... Because HD DVD movies are probably going to start going out at wholesale prices.
That's true. And I hear that Blu-ray is going to increase in price because they've been Blu-ray and HD DVD have been lowering their prices to be competitive and been losing money.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because the format's been out for so long. They've made a big part of their money back. I think they really need to increase the number of players out there, and to do that, to get that economy of scale where they really make the money. They need to bring the price down and get the number of units out there to increase.
All right. Thank you, Sean, for the demise of HD DVD story. And writer, news story?
Okay. Kind of a geeky one. Hopefully it doesn't go over a lot of people's heads. North Dakota judge had ruled in a lawsuit from a spammer to an anti-spammer, and he actually won. The anti-spammer has been fined $60,000. Forget this. Basically, and there may be more to it than this, but he did a zone transfer on a DNS server, which is basically responsible for translating all of your, you know, www.something.com to an IP address that your computer can get to. There's a public registry. You can query it, get information. And he basically was charged for unauthorized access to a DNS server for pulling down domain information in order to determine the identity of the spammer. Using a few other tools, there's a Whois database that basically it's main registry for domain information, which is publicly queryable.
Mm-hmm.
He put this information on his anti-spam website to, you know, kind of keep a registry of spammers. And
there's really tight regulations on what you can do with the data in the DNS register.
Yes, and this is debatable whether it's public, what you can do with this information. Mm-hmm. You know, I know lots of other people take this information. Any site that basically does, a DNS lookup service to see if sites are available are effectively doing the same thing. They're querying and presenting, you know, whether information is available or not. You can publicly look stuff up, and people do it all the time.
Why is this illegal?
Good question. Basically, this judge considered it to be unauthorized access and
so,
was illegal according to North Dakota internet laws.
But having someone send me unsolicited email is, man, that is a pretty...
Yeah. The spammer, got the anti-spammer on a privacy issue.
Exactly, which is exact... Thank you. No. That's perfectly the way that I was okay. trying to say
so
it.
So frustrating.
No, but the kick about this, and I think one of the main gists of it is that they're saying that DNS zone transfers are illegal.
Was he actually transferring?
He was doing a zone query, which is
getting the information.
Is basically the way that DNS servers are set up is you either restrict access to it or you leave it open for people to do. And most people that set up a proper DNS server that don't want people, you know, getting a dump of what information they have for the domain will block access to that. So effectively, if you don't restrict access to it, it becomes public information. Anybody can query
it. So we're talking about like domain name lookup. So what happened was this guy had restrictive domain name lookup, and the way he queried the domain name server to get the restricted information the anti-spammer did is he said, I want to transfer this domain, which then initiates a transfer so that the requester can then contact the person that owns the domain. This isn't assuming that the actual owner has initiated this transfer. Now, the transfer was denied, of course, because the owner didn't want to move it. But in that transfer request, got the data.
A little different. My understanding is that this is actually like a DNS lookup level. Like if you do a dig command.
But you can't get contact information from a dig command, yeah. So
you can get information that's provided. There can be info resources that are listed in there. Whatever you basically populate your DNS server for your domain.
You're saying a domain name's DNS transfer, the transfer would be a request.
A zone transfer, not a domain transfer. So a zone transfer is normally what you would have two servers that are mirroring each other,
yeah.
And a secondary server would basically do a zone transfer request,
right.
And it would if it was allowed, it would basically send all the zone information to the other server, and
right.
That's basically text.
Right.
You can read that.
Okay, I got what you're saying.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. It was geeky, and I appreciate it. This is Geek Speak, after all. That was Ryder Brooks. We also have Sean Cleveland, Ben Jaffe, and Drew Meyer. We're going to circle around one more time. Ben, it's your turn for a news story. Black? You're wearing a black sweater. Should we cover that?
Yeah, sure.
I love this story.
I've got two quick ones, and
okay.
I'll do the black one first. So researchers have made what is now the darkest material on the Earth, and it's, what is it, like four times darker than the previous darkest
almost
material?
Almost 10 times darker.
Like
four times darker than the...
And 10 times darker than the one that the Guinness Book of World Records currently recognizes. And
right.
Like really, really dark, and it's made of tiny carbon nanotubes, which are just on their end, and they absorb all the light,
like a whole bunch of hair, kind of on
the
substrate.
And so, what they do is they measure light light reflection with something called the reflective index. And typical black paint is like 5 to 10% reflective index.
And that would be basically, we'd see it as black. Like someone's sweater wearing it's black. We'd see that as black, and that's like a 5 to 10%.
Probably like 10% or something. And this new material has an index of 0.045%.
So a lot darker.
Way, way darker. Absorbs almost all the light.
To get an idea of this, my mother's a painter, so I've always kind of engaged in this kind of concept of what we see and how we see it. Black is the lack of seeing something. But if you see a black object near you right now, if you look around and see a black object, you actually can see it. You see normally reflection off of light bouncing off. Like your sweater right now, I can see that there's a whole bunch of gray on the right-hand side because you're next to a window. And on the left-hand side, it's darker, but I can still see it. And there's still stuff reflecting. Basically, if you had a sweater of this, you would not see it. It would actually be so frustrating for your eye that you might get a little nauseous about it and because it'd be a void. So I'm kind of excited about large objects being passed around.
And they have this amazing picture of a little sample of that material next to I don't know exactly what the thing it's next to is, but it's this picture taken with a flash, and it looks like someone just photoshopped out a hole.
Yeah,
you know, just made it pure black in the picture. It's just amazing.
The other quick story, go ahead.
Yeah, the other quick story is that the I don't know if you guys covered this in a previous show, but the 17 Express that goes between Santa Cruz and San Jose now offers Wi-Fi service.
Oh, man.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that.
At least they're introducing it. So over the next couple months, or I think is their time period.
Oh, that's really compelling.
They're going to put Wi-Fi in. So you can, and I came up with this myself. I don't know if anyone else came up with this, but you can compute while you commute.
Okay, well, maybe I will do an interview at Google. That sounds kind of fun.
Google already has a shuttle that gives you free wireless
access. Yeah, but not all the way over here.
Yes.
Really?
To Scotts Valley.
Really?
I've considered working there for exactly that sole reason. Who cares what the company is?
We should both do interviews that we do together.
Oh, man.
No, I like my job. I like my
So you realize that service is entirely lost to anybody that suffers from motion sickness while they take the bus.
That's true.
Yeah. I used to take the bus.
I cannot read for a second when I'm on the bus.
So you get for commute, you get to pop a motion sickness pill and then get your laptop out.
That's a work hazard.
Well, it's better than, you know, computing while you drive.
I wonder about reception. I mean, 17 is pretty spotty.
Yeah.
I mean, even for cell service.
Okay,
I think it's a satellite thing.
Oh, okay.
So is whatever.
I guess that's what the trains are using too, with the Caltrains.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ryder, for the motion sickness thing. How about this? The reason we get motion sickness is because our eyes' input is not what our body's feeling. It's a mismatch. That's why if you're driving a car and you actually look out the window the entire time, or you'll get a feeling of how your body's actually moving, and therefore you won't be as nauseous easily. That's why when people drive, normally they don't get nauseous, but if you're in the back seat, you do. So what about your screen minimizes down to a small screen, and then it floats around based on how your movement is. So it's actually trying to show you that your body's moving by the screen portion moving. Think that would work, or you just get sicker?
I would get sicker.
Okay.
For me, I either have to watch the road, or I have to like go to sleep or something. Yeah. Oddly, you know, lack of sensory of visual input seems to work fine for me.
Yeah,
I close my eyes, but
so you can listen to stuff on your iPod or something.
Yeah,
I guess.
So I could listen to streamed music, I guess.
All right. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. That's 476-2800. Or toll free at 1-800-655-5877.
OK, KUSP co-sponsors UCSC Arts and Lectures presentation of Anonymous 4 with instrumentalists Daryl Anger and Scott Nygaard. Anonymous 4's music is interwoven with poetry and narrative. On this tour, they welcome instrumentalist Grammy-nominated violinist Daryl Anger and Scott Nygaard, considered the absolute cutting-edge guitar player in today's acoustic music scene. Together, these six performers will present music from Anonymous 4's albums Gloryland and American Angels. That's 8 p.m. Saturday, January 26th, at the UCSC Recital Hall. Information at 459-2159 or online at artslectures.ucse.edu.
This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Drew Meyer. We also have Ryder Brooks, Ben Jaffe, and Sean Cleveland. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. For the next half an hour, we will be taking your calls and questions. And after that, it's Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. As we wait for calls to come in, let's go ahead and do some more news.
We've got two calls. We already have two calls. Line, man.
All right, we'll do that. Well, then introduce line one, would you?
Oh, yeah. So Scott in Utica, upstate New York, he's got a question about portability. Looking for, it looks like a portable display and a keyboard. Scott, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for calling all the way in from the East Coast there.
Yes, I usually listen to your podcast, but I made a special effort to be in front of my computer today. And that's part of the problem. I want to be able to connect to my computer but walk around the house. I'd like a display and keyboard that I could be connected. I've got four computers in the house for my two sons and my wife, and I was thinking, why can't we all have just one computer, but with four Wi-Fi connected displays? Is there anything available to do that?
If you did a remote access to your main machine,
and without going for a laptop, I've got four computers that are connected through a wireless hub.
Yeah. There's no marketing product that I know of that does kind of what you're talking about. You can do a few things that are similar.
What you're asking for is a terminal, essentially, or that in our world, the lingo is terminal, where you have one computer that has all the intelligence and then a number of different views into that computer. And like Sean was saying, there's a feature of Windows called, technically terminal services, but remote access is...
Remote access is
what you'll
services,
see on,
yeah.
Yeah. And that'll let you do it, but you still have to have a computer... like a notebook to function as the display. It just looks at, it just gives you a window into that one main computer.
Banks and a lot of corporations and businesses do that. They've got big servers, blade servers. They're located somewhere
safe and secure,
yeah. And then you've got these, what are they called?
VNC?
No, they're not called terminals, but you do need a processor of some sort.
Thin client?
Just a thin client, yeah. So it's just not very powerful, but it gives you it's got maybe a few connectivity, it's got a network connection, it's got a keyboard and a screen, and you connect remotely to the server, and all the processing is happening on the server.
Yeah.
It's just sending calls back and forth.
But what's the actual device they're using? Aren't they normally using desktop machines?
Yes and no. A thin client is a specific type of machine you can buy that has just the barest, thinnest, minimum hardware in it.
The thing with these, though, is they're marketed towards corporations, and so the cost point's not low enough.
For Scott, I don't think it's a very good solution.
Yeah, but like a tablet PC, something with a really smaller screen, if it runs Windows, you can do remote access to your to any desktop, to multiple desktops, and it doesn't need a high-end processor to do that.
Why do you want, if you've got four machines, Scott, why do you want to change the way things are working right now?
Well, just so that I could go and sit in front of my television in the other room and still be connected to the internet I was working.
So is that television...
Or go sit in the kitchen.
Right. Okay, so you want to be able to move anywhere. So what's the screen that you're going to use for this computer? You want a portable screen with a keyboard?
Yeah.
See, that's the thing is that the cheapest way to get a portable screen and a keyboard is to get a low-end laptop.
Go buy a notebook off of eBay or from in the newspaper. That's the cheapest thing you can find. Load Linux on it and use it as a browser.
Yeah, but he wants to connect through...
He wants to actually connect to his computer, access his data, just as if he's at his computer.
But you could do a VNC from Linux.
Sure.
It's true. I wonder if there's a nice, like, thin client Linux version.
What about
what's it called? Fast VNC or really small VNC or something? Yeah, there's one that's really, really fast.
Right, like, that's an application that runs on an OS.
Yeah, it's an application, but I don't know if it is for Windows, there's a Mac, lot.
Or use a super thin Windows install.
If you're using a local LAN environment, just Windows, just using the remote desktop protocol with Windows is often pretty
good.
Happy.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it better than using VNC locally.
So you basically need to get that hardware that you want to be at. If you want to be at a keyboard and a screen, you've got to get that. And the most inexpensive way to do that is to get like a used laptop. But you want to be able to make sure they can run an OS that's relatively safe. And I think we're going to go with that. Mm-hmm. Is that good for you, Scott?
Well, yeah, it seems
there's no obvious easy solution.
Then I want to go. I was looking for something really simple.
I don't think they exist. I think
this sounds like I need I definitely would have to have an operating system on the on this. And so, of course, when you except for something like Ubuntu, you'd have to be buying Windows or.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But I think you could do this all with Ubuntu.
Oh yeah.
I think you really could get an Ubuntu laptop. You'd connect with your Wi-Fi. For browsing and stuff, you just use the Firefox that comes with Ubuntu. And if you do need to connect up, you'd use a client called a VNC. And there's
you can read about it on the web. It's not an uncommon thing.
Fast VNC is probably a good solution. So we're talking about a low-end laptop running Ubuntu, security safe, free OS, and you're set.
Yeah, the hardware's going to be $100, maybe $200.
I think I might make one of these for my kid.
Oh. Yeah. If you break it, so what?
Yeah, it sounds like a fun project, too.
Good luck on it. Let us know how it goes, Scott. Thanks for the call.
Okay, have a good day.
But keep in mind, if you make it for your son, maybe the hardware, you could do it cheap, but you're giving him connectivity to all your data on a separate piece of hardware.
You got to give filtered content, that's for sure. Yeah, that would be, that's why it doesn't have a laptop, a computer right now. It's a whole learning curve I've got to do. I'm sure that in the next few years, GeekSpeak will get pretty focused on how to protect your kids because I've got a 6-year-old and he's learning too quickly.
One laptop per child.
That's right.
All right.
From Santa Cruz, John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning, guys. Good morning, geeks. How you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today, sir?
You know, I'm calling because this is one of those ever-evolving questions that I think a lot of people have, and I'm hoping you guys can help me. I just upgraded my laptop over Christmas to new Windows Vista machine. Of course, I went out and got a nice processor and 2 gig of RAM, and you know I'm happy with it and everything. And I used to use antivirus. I had a combination that was working, but things change on Vista, and you know I'm trying to keep up. And I went to your website and I looked at your website, and I know that you guys recommend Adaware and SpyBot. I was just wondering I have a couple of questions around that, and trying to get the latest. And here's what these questions revolve around. First of all, everything seems to be varying degrees of complication and integration, and Windows has got its own firewall available, and then there's external solutions. There's McAfee, there's Norton, and those guys seem to be very resource-intensive.
Yeah.
And there's things like Trend Micro or CA Associates and some other things that are out there. I can't remember all of them. I'm trying to find is, low resource consumption, best performance combination. Mm-hmm. I just wonder what you guys think about that. I don't want to duplicate resources, and I don't want to overtax, this new higher-performing system.
Well, the first thing I think all of us do is pay attention to our interaction with the Internet and make the first effect be the most, protect ourselves from the get-go. And that involves making sure you've got a router so that it's hard to get port scanned. Now, once that's happened, a firewall's not the most important part of what's happening. At that point, then you got to look at your vectors of virus infectation, right? So, and that would be email and websites. So the first thing we suggest is you do not use Microsoft email browser and you do not use Microsoft web browser. Use Firefox. And that will help in some ways. And then both of the email client and the browser, you can restrict their security stuff. So basically, you're just going to kind of cut down any way that you could get infected.
Yeah, don't open attachments from people you don't know.
Now, honestly, that is currently how I deal with virus protection on my computer. Now, I recently took my computer to a large LAN environment, and I had to plug in. I made sure before I plugged in that I turned on my firewall and that I started running an antivirus because I wanted to make sure that that was safe. But at home, I don't feel that concern. And then for a laptop, where I'm always going to places and using Wi-Fi and open, I happen to have a Macintosh, so I don't have to worry about it. Anybody else want to add in on this, on the vector aspect?
Dee Dee makes a good point that secure your own machine first and then think about the layers outward from that instead of trying to build a wall around all your machines and secure inward.
So she goes opposite.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a free program on the internet called Tor, the Onion Router, T-O-R. Tor will hide and mask where you're coming from so that you can browse sites and they can't be traced directly back to you, which is a very useful tool for privacy if it's a big concern for you, but it does slow down your performance.
A lot of this stuff will slow down your performance.
Yeah. Now, about the
virus. But so when you secure your machine, you are running a lot of software in the background. Yeah.
Now, so that's another thing is the configuration of that software is really important. So if you install like Norton Antivirus and you just let it go and then you never modify it, it is going to be a system hog. But what you do is you install it, you run all these features, and then you go into the settings and you slowly disable the things you don't need running all the time. And then you make sure you run that at certain periods.
So let me be greedy and take you. You know, and be more specific and say, look, I'm running a laptop in a home environment through a wireless router, okay? Mm-hmm. And I travel out and I use a Verizon wireless modem or a wireless, you know, cellular-based modem for internet access. And sometimes I use Wi-Fi at the local coffee shops if it's quick and I just want to hop on and hop up. So given that and understanding that I want to, you know, I'm greedy. I want to keep my resources, my performance resources in the most low-maintenance universal solution. What do you recommend? And what do you guys hear about things like Webroot Spy Sweeper was something somebody had mentioned to me as a low resource intensive application.
You know, man, you want the whole world in your cake and eat it too. Yeah, I'd like to have the same deal. But if you ever leave your home and go out to a coffee shop and open up your machine, unless you've got a pile of software running that you trust and are willing to take a little hit on your performance, you can't be safe. There's no other way around it.
Well, I'm willing to, if that's what I got to do, let's set our hierarchy of needs here. My hierarchy of needs here is data integrity. I don't want to, you know, when that blue screen, you know, nobody wants to see that. Nobody wants to suffer that.
Right.
You know, you tell somebody after the fact when their hard drive crashes, hey, you know, for $40, if I said to you right now, give me $100 and I'll make this go away.
Right.
They'd give you 200 in a flash
I think the answer is you've got to run all these resources on your machine and you've got to deal with that. Now you can turn them off when you're in your private network if you feel a little safer about that network.
Yeah, or just be prepared to face the pain, back up your data. I mean, I've never had a virus wipe out my hard drive or crash it. Knock on wood, and I shouldn't say that out loud, but pay attention to what you're doing, and if the pain of the performance is too big a price to pay, then figure out what the consequences are worth.
To make sure your complete loss of your system wouldn't affect you. Maybe
these days, I'm more concerned about getting updates that hurt
keep you on the defense.
The software. Unusable.
Yeah, so I run my updates. I run Microsoft updates all the time. I had an XP-based machine, and I ran Adaware and SpyBot religiously, once a week at least. So I had all my updates in. I had, you know, an old IT guy said, just run them. Just run all the updates. You're not a smart enough guy. Just run them. And he's right. You know, let's just keep everything up to date. And I was running McAfee. But the problem was, after a while, you know, with all these terminate and stay resident programs in the background, you know, you're just hogging resources. And eventually, the system just can't keep up. And
yeah,
I was
so,
trying to be a little proactive on the new system, even though I get 2 gig.
So the next thing to do is every year reinstall your complete OS and wipe your system and reinstall your OS and install the newest stuff.
I don't think you need to run every service in the background. A mail scanning service, I think, is probably the most important thing you can run because that's how a lot of people get infected.
Remember, the hackers are trying to get into the biggest open doors first. So if you do a little bit to push the defensive levels up a little higher, you know, run Thunderbird, run Ubuntu, or run Mozilla. You're going to protect yourself better than most people. Thunderbird is the email client from Mozilla. So instead of Outlook or Outlook Express, you use Thunderbird.
Another thing to point out is that some of these virus scanners, when they attempt to do email scanning and things like that, they often are hooked into particular applications plugins. So they're not. You know, it may not work with Thunderbird. It may only work with Outlook and Outlook Express.
That's
so you got to pay attention to if you're enabling services for something that you're not even utilizing.
Sure. The next part of that question is, do you guys have, if you're using Thunderbird and if you're using Mozilla, Firefox, do you guys have a particular predilection or I don't know, experience
for virus protection?
Antivirus?
I use AVG, and that's what we're suggesting still, I believe, on
GeekSpeak. It's a free, very capable.
Thank you, John, for the call.
You know, something else,
that this
too,
is so frustrating.
When you're at a cafe or you're in a public environment and you're surfing on the web, any share that you have to your data is accessible to anyone out there if you're not using a password.
Yeah.
So if you're just booting into Windows, no password, anybody can get access to that share. I mean, it's not that difficult. So
yeah, I'm using a password.
Definitely use a password in public places.
Thank you, John, so much for the call.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for the help.
This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air, we're geeks Drew Meyer, Ryder Brooks, Ben Jaffe, and Sean Cleveland. We're taking calls and questions of technology. Rick Fillman is answering the phone. And the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Santa Cruz, Jack, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, guys. I was just listening to your previous conversation, and I just throw my 2 cents in with that before I ask my question.
Sure.
You could rent a virtual private network out of Sweden for about 10 euros a month, you know, or less.
Mm-hmm.
And you can run everything over that when you're sitting in a cafe somewhere, and that will really cut down the possibility of somebody hacking it. You know, somebody sitting in that room.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. So we're again talking kind of about thin client idea, and that you're going to run your system locally, which you don't care about very much, and then you're going to connect with a service that has good encryption to a machine that's safely behind a lot of protection.
Right.
That's a good idea. It's a one step away. Of course, effectively, if your machine gets hacked and over-controlled, the thin client part of it, it could then infect through the connection that you have. But it's a good second step. Jack, what's your question today?
Okay, my question is, I have been holding out with my old 21-inch Trinitron multi-scan.
Attaboy. And, you know, keeping it out of the landfill. I like
nice,
that.
Nice.
Well, listen, man, if they would have made the machine, I would have bought it by now. And that's what I'm wondering about, because I can't find anything. I mean, I want to hook into a big screen at this point. I don't want to get like a 26-inch or a 30-inch screen anymore. I want something that's like 47 inches.
Wait, for your computer or
exactly.
For your television?
Everything in my house is, you know, it goes through my computer. So I don't have any separate systems, whether it be, you know, television or anything.
Well, I would take a look at the release of monitors at CES, but there is a very
large... What
was
that? I didn't hear that.
Last week's show, we talked a lot about monitors that are coming out in CES. And they've got a large curved monitor. They've got a... four times the size of HD.
That's all interesting stuff, but you're not going to see it for several years. But just keep in mind that when you buy a large LCD or plasma screen TV and you hook up a computer to it, it's not going to look as good as an LCD built for a computer.
That's right.
Because the maximum resolution is like, it's like 1600 by 1080. So 1080i, 1080p, that's the lines of resolution. Yeah, so when you start getting to like a 24-inch monitor, I mean, that's got a resolution of 19 by 12. A 30-inch monitor for a computer has a resolution of 25 by 1600. So those look awesome on a computer. But when you get these big 40-inch screens and even larger, the maximum lines you have is 1080.
And the way to make them look good is to sit far enough away.
You need to sit farther away, and then, of course, if you sit too far away, you can't really surf the web because you can't see the text. I found that running Vista is better than XP because it resizes the icons and the text in such a way that it's easier to read from a distance.
Oh, it does that?
Yeah. So I would recommend Vista on a media center.
But if your primary focus is computer use and you want to use it as a secondary as your main screen, 30 inches is what the size, and it's expensive.
Is that the largest computer monitor that's made now, 30
inches?
Yeah,
I think so.
But you know what? They're going to give us what we want. You know what I mean?
And then if you get a 30-inch flat screen or LCD, computer LCD, and you want to use that as your TV, that's fine. But keep in mind that those take a dual-link DVI connection, and you need a powerful graphics card with support for dual-link DVI to drive that screen.
Which means you can't just plug in your cable box.
Yeah. And then most motherboards...
The equipment part is fine. I don't have any concerns there. Like my system, I upgrade it continually. But it's just, you know, I haven't found anything to compete with my old, you know, multi-scan G500 yet. I mean, not within reason.
Yeah.
You know, because it just scales any way I want it.
You know, Jack, it's just not there. I have the same issue. We do a lot of computer and television watching on the same setup, and I'd rather have one monitor that is both. And the best way to do it now is have a smaller room and use a 30-inch LCD.
30-inch is the best. Huh?
Which is very expensive and not something I'm forking.
But if you get a 30-inch LCD, don't cheap out. Get one with a hardware scaler. So the Gateway 30-inch has one. It's really nice, which means that you can scale at different resolutions. The original Dell 30-inch does not have a hardware scaler. If you're playing games, doing that sort of thing, not so great.
It looks pretty bad.
The new Dell 30-inch has HDMI and it's got the next generation DisplayPort. And it's got a hardware scaler. It's really nice. So
I like that one, huh?
So, but those are really expensive. You're thousands of dollars for a, you know, just a 30-inch computer monitor.
Where if you come down like...
Whereas you can get a 42-inch 1080p TV LCD for a little over $1,000 now.
Right. Yeah, I know that you could get those Westinghouses for quite some time for cheap, you know?
Thank you, Jack, very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Take care. Well, we had a clarification that there is a Google shuttle that goes right down to downtown Santa Cruz, so that's kind of nice if you work for Google, one of the best companies in the world to work for. We're going to go ahead and go to Santa Cruz again. Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, this is Tom.
Hi, Tom. What's your comment today?
Well, I have a couple computers, and I'm not very good at this stuff, but I have a laptop and a Pentium 4 in it. It's a Sony Vaio. And it's all filled up with a bunch of programs and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And I'm not very good at this. And I saw this, it's called Speed Up My PC by UniBlue. And it'll get rid of programs and stuff like that. Have you heard of UniBlue?
No, I've never heard of this.
What's your question? You want to see if it's any good?
You want to know if it's any good?
Well, it sort of scares me and stuff like that. Is that a... what's the best way to get rid of...
what's the best way to test device stuff that's running? To know if this is a good thing to run or not, basically.
Yeah.
We normally Google things. Do anybody have a really good site about like all the processes on a machine?
No. If no one's talking about this program on, you can't find any hits on Google, don't install it.
Or if
they are and they all say it's wonderful, then you got a little, the wisdom of the herd here, I guess.
That's right. So okay, really, it's just a phrase that you search in Google, and you might want to add something like process to it or
performance or security, or things like that. Stability. Yeah.
Well, one of the question I have is like on my add and remove programs, it has like let's say like the installer takes up 30 megabytes.
Right.
Can I delete that installer and still keep my program?
No.
Okay.
You could move it somewhere else where it's not going to be in your way.
Well, not necessarily, because there might be links in the registry to say this is where the program is and may not run if you just move it.
Okay, so that answers my question.
Something you could do is right-click on, go to Windows Explorer and right-click on your C drive or your D drive or whichever one is filling up, and go to Properties and then delete or clean up. You want to do a drive cleanup. It'll go through and remove all the temporary files on that drive and all the rest of the stuff you don't need, and you'll be surprised by how much gets cleaned up.
It's called disk cleanup.
Yeah, disk cleanup.
Thank you very much for the call,
Tom. That's a good place to start.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I don't like installing weird stuff on my machine that tells me it's going to make it go faster. I mean, I don't... That's just me. Mm-hmm. I don't trust them longer than I can throw them.
God, there's a great utility that gives you a visual display of your hard drive and shows you what's taking up the most space.
Oh, I've got a bunch of squares on it.
It's a bunch of squares, and you'll be surprised. You can see really quickly what's taking up space.
I was running out of space on the machine and ran something like that and found out I had a whole ISO image I'd forgotten about.
Yeah,
which was
a giant block.
There it is.
So
For the Mac, it's called Disk Inventory.
Okay.
Ooh. We'll look it up for the PC and put that on our website.
Which is geekspeak.org. I believe we're going to be able to take one more call. We're going to take it from Watsonville. Robert, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I was talking to D-Link tech support, and I couldn't manually configure my wired router. They suggested bridge mode. What is it? Is it slower, or is it less secure?
Do you have another router in there anywhere?
Nope.
Boy, the bridge mode that I'm familiar with is taking a router and wirelessly connecting it to another similar type of a router, usually an identical model, so that you have two routers that are acting like they're on the same network.
Oh, I thought that was like daisy chain.
Kind of like that, so that you can move around a broader space but still stay on the same network, and it'll switch the connection between the routers for you.
Is this wired or wireless?
Wired.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
I'm
not an expert in NetGear stuff or D-Link stuff.
Typically, so. when you bridge stuff, you're taking two interfaces that would normally be their own subnets and their own private network, bridging them so they share the same network and information across the Ethernet passes across the interface, so you can send broadcasts and it goes across both interfaces. But I don't really know why they would recommend that for you.
Well, it wouldn't manually configure, and it wasn't because the modem and the router had the same IP address.
So one thing is like you've got a DSL modem. Mm-hmm. Is that how you're getting in? So does a DSL modem have multiple ports on it, multiple Ethernet jacks?
One.
Only one. Okay, that means it's probably a standalone modem. It's not a router. So then you really do want a second router because you want to be protected from the traffic.
Uh-huh.
You need one router somewhere.
You need one router, yeah,
right.
Which you have.
So the configuration you need to do is on that router you should have one port that's a little special. And it should say something like internet or WAN, something like that. You want to plug the DSL modem to that. Then when configuring this box, you should be able to reset it somehow. And when you reset it, it gets the passwords and everything. All the configuration goes back to the default.
I did that.
Okay. Then you plug into one of the other ports of your computer. Now, that machine should be giving a new domain or DHCP information to your computer right out of the box, the default setting. At that point, you want to go into the web configuration of that router. And it should – in most cases, that's all functional. If that's not functional, I would first off would try to see if the DSL modem was working. Now, if you're adding a router to this whole block, it's possible your computer was configured in such a way that it only wants to listen to the DSL. So if you plug in the DSL modem directly and it's working with internet, and then you plug in the router and try to get the router in there, and you can't seem to access the router, you want to look on your Windows machine and actually enable things on that will allow you to connect to that router. So that, or the router. Probably the problem.
Was it D-Link you were saying?
D-Link.
Those guys should have been able to walk you through the basic troubleshooting stuff that we're doing.
I did. It wouldn't work.
Yeah. I think you probably have a bad router.
It's brand new.
Yeah. That doesn't mean it's not bad. Things come bad. We all get it every once in a while. And it's a very frustrating situation because you buy it and you're like, it's brand new. I know it's not the problem. And after 3 days of trying to figure it out, you go, maybe this is the problem. And it is. And then you have to return it. Mm-hmm. So I would, if you're at the point where D-Link does not know how to fix this and it's their product and it's still supported.
And it worked before you brought the D-Link thing in.
I would take it back and get another one of a different unit even. So that's my recommendation for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert, for the call.
Google around that thing. This is pretty common network troubleshooting stuff. A lot of people have the similar problems.
Yeah.
You might be able to find it on the web.
So they were recommending that he plug it in right into one interface and then set up a second network interface and then bridge them together and do internet connection sharing?
We don't really know.
I think that D-Link was
pretty.
I think D-Link was thinking that he has a DLSL existing modem, a router, and so that there was two networks, and so that was the problem, is that he had. And
that would make
that
sense. If he had a combo router/DSL modem that was already there, and then he added the D-Link router,
but
you'd have to put the two routers together to make it all work.
But those types of DSL modems, which a router almost always have more than one Ethernet port.
Yeah, so that was a good question. Mystery.
Mystery may be solved. It says mystery. Let me call us back and let us know. You're listening to Geek Speak. The geeks this morning were Sean Cleveland, Ryder Brooks, Drew Meyer, Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxel. So we probably have time for one more news story if it's a quick one. Anybody?
Oh, yeah, the CIA and hackers cutting the power supply in the United States.
Do it.
Well, the CIA disclosed recently that they've declassified some attacks that have occurred in the United States where hackers hacked in and extorted money from the power utilities or threatened to cut the power grid. And in fact, they've demonstrated that this can be done by video, turning a spinning generator into smoke.
Wait, this really happened?
This really happened, and the CIA just finally released it. And there's no details in this story about where it was or what cities were affected, but they admitted that it is a very real threat, and they're going to be looking very hard at improving security and cyberspace for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Wow. Well, thanks for that update, and kind of scary that our grid's that insecure.
Maybe you should be off the grid, huh?
I guess so. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Thank you all for participating in GeekSpeak. Geeks, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Oh, that application's Winderstat.
Winderstat. We will add that to geekspeak.org.
Winderstat.info.
Oh, dot info, Winderstat.
If you need to clear up space, go grab that utility. It's pretty cool.
Geekspeak.org is the place to find that in about an hour. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Broadcasting in HD radio on 80.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto. On the web at KOSP.org. For KOSP and Geekspeak, I'm Lyle Troxel.
You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxel for KUSP. Thanks for listening.